here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, research shows that most police calls don't involve active crime situations. We'll look at the types of calls they do respond to and how city leaders and police chiefs around the country are looking at different ways to respond to particular kinds of non-criminal emergencies. First, many people are trying to make do with whatever life has thrown their way lately, and for some, that's meant moving in with family. Some college students and young adults are choosing to stay home or moving back in with parents if being on campus, for example, isn't necessary. And some older adults might be moving in with their adult children to help watch the grandkids while childcare is hard to come by. And while multi-generational living has increased in the last few months for many cultures and countries, it's the norm. Even through the history of the U.S., we've seen some ebb and flow when it comes to extended families living together. Nicholas Lovett is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater with the Department of Economics. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, I know we'll probably find out a lot more from the census, but from what you see out there, how much do you see this happening, multiple generations ending up living together over the last few months?
Oh, I see quite a lot of it. I live in a fairly residential neighborhood, and I frequently see grandparents pushing strollers with small kids in them and going back to a home or a household where we have three generations living together. So really seeing quite a lot of it these days. It's been sort of a general increase in the past 10 to 15 years, but in the past several months with the pandemic, it's really picked up quite a bit.
Yeah, let's talk about pre-pandemic. And I've seen some research out there that shows this was happening. I don't know, maybe in part because of the Great Recession. What's behind this wider trend even before COVID-19?
Yeah, it's definitely been picking up a lot, and it picked up a lot during the Great Recession and since then. And I sort of think that economic factors are sort of the biggest thing kind of driving this change in housing patterns. In the last 15 to 20 years, the economy's changed quite a bit, in some ways not for the better in the sense that fewer people are able to extract kind of a middle-class existence out of the economy. And those that are generally earning more than they were previously. And some of the groups that are not doing quite as well in this sort of newer economy are young adults and the elderly. And so oftentimes those folks are living with what we might call prime age working adults, maybe their parents or their adult children, to sort of smooth out some of the frictions that they're experiencing economically. That's kind of been driving a lot of this change towards multi-generational cohabitation or housing for the past 10 years or so. But there's also been some other things that maybe aren't economic in nature. America's become more diverse, and we've had more immigration from Latin America and East Asian societies where multi-generational housing is sort of very much the norm or the standard. And as America's demographics shift in that direction, it's perhaps not surprising that we're seeing more households living like that. And then finally, parents tend to invest more in their children these days than perhaps they did in the past. We see a lot less structured play and a lot more sort of, quote, investments in children's experiences. And having grandparents on hand can really help with that kind of thing, particularly the high intensity parenting that we're seeing in middle class and wealthy families in America these days.
We've seen multi-generational housing in the U.S. in the past, right? I mean, I think of shows like The Waltons, representing there was grandpa and there were grandkids and all points in between. This isn't the first time we've been here, right?
No, absolutely not. In fact, my mother, I know that she lived with her grandmother for many years, and that was kind of the standard in my own family lineage. Going back to the 40s and the 30s and the 50s when my mother was a small girl. But since the 1950s, we've generally seen it decline and then kind of pick up again in the past 15 years or so. So going quite a ways back, very standard, and maybe also a bit of a reflection back then of some of the tougher economics back then. And then we sort of saw this great rise in equality and prosperity following World War II that maybe allowed people to live independently much more so. And now the economy is changing again. I wouldn't say it's worse. In the aggregate, it's more prosperous, but there are perhaps more people sort of being left behind a little bit. And that might be driving part of this.
Talking to Nicholas Lovett from UW-Whitewater, we're looking at the resurgence, especially under COVID-19, but it started before that, of multi-generational families, maybe three generations in a family living under the same roof. Is that you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Nick, I know there have been a lot of stories about the rise of people living alone over the years, and it's kind of become the accepted norm that you go off and live either on your own or you start your own nuclear family, and there's maybe even a stigma of the 20-something still living with their parents. Is that stigma something pretty recent?
I'm not sure how recent it is. I definitely remember when I was in my 20s. I'm in my mid 30s now, and I definitely remember hearing about it then and feeling a little uncomfortable, wondering if I was going to be part of that or not. And the language that I primarily recall that I still hear today is what's called the failure to launch phenomenon. And the idea is that kids graduate from high school or college, and their objective is to get a good middle-class job right away, but that frequently doesn't actually happen. And so they end up living with their parents for several years, and there can be some shame or some stigma associated with that. Whereas in many other societies, in fact, it's the norm to stay with your parents until you get married. But the American experience has generally been that you try to live independently almost as soon as you're done with formal education. But that's not always possible, and there's certainly a stigma sort of associated with that, although that may be declining in the past few years. It's become more and more common, and we know more and more people that are doing this, and we realize the economy is somewhat tougher in some ways than it used to be.
Now, we talked a little bit about the upsides of multi-generational housing these days. Maybe grandpa and or grandma can help take care of the grandkids. Everybody's saving money, hopefully. A unique twist, though, with COVID is that that grandkid might be exposing an at-risk grandparent to disease during this pandemic. How much of a wrench does that throw in this whole concept?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a giant wrench that hopefully won't turn into a giant problem, but certainly could, especially as children return to school or university soon. When we have these multi-generational houses, there are people in the house that have very different risk profiles associated with COVID-19. So elderly people are at much higher risk of serious complications and death. And young people, while still at some degree of risk, are nowhere near as at risk and also tend to be much more risk tolerant in their attitudes about things. So it's really difficult to kind of have a unified household where everyone feels the same commitment to social distancing. You may have an environment where elderly members of the household want to enforce really strict social distancing and really feel it's necessary for their safety and well-being. And then you may also have young people in the household that feel that it's not really a big concern and they want to be free to go out and socialize. I hate to say it, but as they see fit. And that could result in some really serious costs for some elderly members of the household.
Of course, and maybe we'll see this reflected in advice columns around the country, more proximity to relatives and loved ones, even if you love them, can lead to more risk of family conflict, right? Is this something we're going to be sorting out as we maybe readapt to this older-fashioned lifestyle?
Oh, absolutely. As you have more adults in the household, there's going to be more need for compromise. You're going to be stepping on each other's toes quite a bit more. And that's sort of essentially why people have not always wanted to live together in close proximity with extended family, because it's difficult to kind of make sure everyone gets along. So that's certainly going to be an issue. I haven't seen the data in America yet, but there's been a lot of evidence that during the strict lockdown they had in China following the emergence of the COVID virus over there, the divorce rates spiked and have that may be happening here as well. And so that's sort of a symptom of people perhaps stepping on each other's toes during a very difficult, stressful time. And so while it's great that folks can live together and rely on each other, there may also be some tensions that arise with that.
We're talking to Nicholas Lovett, assistant professor at UW-Whitewater with the Department of Economics. More people are finding themselves in multi-generational living situations, young adults staying with or moving back in with parents, for example, or grandparents moving in. It's happening more during the pandemic. It was actually gaining steam even before then. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you now, or was this you? Has the number of people in your household increased in the last few months or last few years? Or did you grow up with multiple generations in your household? What was it like? Do you have advice for the first-timers out there right now? Join in with your questions, thoughts, and maybe your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Nicholas Lovett, assistant professor at UW-Whitewater in the Department of Economics. We're talking about intergenerational housing, living with, say, older family members, having adult children move back into the house, whatever the case might be. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you doing this now, having multiple people, multiple generations in your family household right now? Have you been doing it for a long time? Is this new or old to you? Share your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Let's go to Gabby with us in Dodgeville. Gabby, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Gabby?
Well, so my husband and I live with my mother, and we've been doing it for 5 years. Or actually, she moved in with us, and we have 3 children. And you know what? It's not without its struggles every once in a while. I mean, there's kind of a lack of privacy. But it's really nice for our kids to have that time with their grandma. And it's nice for her to have that time with them. They're really creating these memories and these bonds that are going to last them a lifetime. In addition, it's really nice to have a built-in babysitter if we want to go on a date.
Gabby, thank you so much for sharing that story. I appreciate it, Nick. And Gabby, I think probably not the only one in that almost exact situation, Nick.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a lot of pros to having an adult parent in the house with you to help out with the kids. Right now, with people working from home or working on site, it's almost necessary until children are able to sort of safely return to school. And there's certainly this sort of personal upside where you can have stronger relationships within the family. And there's also substantial evidence that the children really benefit from the additional attention of having a third adult in the household, or maybe third and fourth adult in the household, to provide them with attention and care and education and all those great things.
Thanks a lot for that call, Gabby, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Sid now in Milwaukee. Sid, hi.
Hello?
Sid, hi. Go ahead.
Oh, hey. Yeah, so I could see the usefulness of it, especially in places like L.A. or New York, where it just costs so darn much to live, you know, like, just for the economics of it, even if it's not purely, you know, the emotional aspect of it, the economics might be worthwhile.
Sid, thanks a lot for that call. Sid brings up a great point, Nick, that I hadn't gotten to yet. The rent is really high. Housing costs are really high, you know, in big cities, like you mentioned, but a lot of other communities around the country. Is that a potential driver here of people wanting to pay one less rent or mortgage?
Yeah, Sid really raises a great point, and that's that this can be a great way of reducing costs. Although here in Wisconsin and the Midwest, sort of an interesting phenomenon is that we typically live in very large homes here in Wisconsin and the Midwest relative to the coastal parts of the country. So although the costs of living are somewhat lower, it makes it a lot easier to cohabitate with, say, your in-laws or something like that. There's a lot more space in the house. So that's sort of a potentially a driver locally, is that it's relatively easier or less difficult to have another adult in the household when you have a bigger house. And Americans are consuming bigger houses than they used to. So even though housing has become more expensive, Americans have more square footage per person than they ever have. And I think that may also sort of feed back into having more people in the household of multiple generations. But Sid raises a great point.
Sid, thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go to Greg with us now in Janesville. Greg, hi.
Hi. Say, we 20 years ago, my father told me that they wanted to rent and didn't want to own any longer. So I thought to myself, maybe I'll buy a duplex. And I did. One side is owner occupied and the other side is a renter place. It's smaller. So we were together, but yet we had enough privacy between ourselves. I put in a privacy fence between our decks, but they were always there if we needed them to watch our daughter at the time. And we checked in on each other. And then you're talking about mortgage payments. The rent that we got paid for 3/4 of our mortgage payment. So that was great too.
Greg, thanks a lot for that call. And I've heard of this approach, Nick, getting families getting multi-unit things. So you're not literally in the same space, but there's just a wall separating you. Is Greg part of a trend there too, do you think?
I think it's been around for quite a while, but Greg is a little bit of part of a trend in the sense that one sort of new development we've seen in the American housing market has been the development of what are sometimes called backyard cottages. So while the duplex has been around for a while and the in-law unit above the garage has been around for a while and maybe more popular now than ever, sort of a new thing has been the backyard cottage or cabin, where you'll have an independent structure built in the backyard or front yard, wherever it may be. And your in-laws will reside there, and that can help you share the housing cost and also give everyone sort of enough space while still also reaping the benefits of having someone nearby to assist with the family and things of that nature.
Greg, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at long-term trends, Nick, we've talked about housing costs some. How about wages, especially for people, you know, in the bottom third or even two-thirds of the wage scale? Is part of the story here that those wages are stagnant and making it hard to afford those higher housing costs?
Well, in the last 30 years or so, we've seen what some people refer to as the great divergence in wages, and that's the sense that, you know, 1980 or 1990, the differences in wages between someone with a college education and someone that didn't were relatively much smaller. They've gotten much, much larger. And so we're seeing this big divergence in the earnings capacities of different Americans. And for folks at the lower end of that income spectrum, the housing market's gotten real difficult. And this is especially true in some of the coastal areas that one of the previous callers referred to. I used to live in the Bay Area of California, and boy, that's a tough housing market. It's getting to the point where there are entire cities where virtually no one lives there unless they have a six-figure income or more. And that's making things real tough. And on top of that, there are very strong environmental regulations in some of these high-cost areas that make it really difficult to expand the housing supply and therefore lower the prices. So we're certainly in a bit of a tough predicament in that regard.
Looking to the future, Nick, do you think that this is something that's going to stick, this multi-generational family trend, or is this something we're just kind of putting up with as we deal with, you know, COVID and the long-term impacts of the Great Recession, and we're going to hope to get out of it as soon as we can?
I think it's a great question. I think there's really sort of two things going on here. There's this sort of short-run spike that's being driven by COVID, and I do sort of expect that to go away and return back to sort of a baseline level. It's not clear when that's going to happen because we don't really know when COVID's going to be under control. But I would suspect that once children are able to return to school safely and their parents are able to return to work in a normal fashion safely, we'll see some sort of big retrenchment back to pre-COVID levels. However, the sort of high baseline level, I don't think is going to go away anytime soon. If anything, I expect it to continue. The economic forces that are encouraging this are not going anywhere anytime soon. Parents increasingly want more and more attention and investment in a smaller number of children than they've had in the past. And American demographics are also changing and becoming more and more from Latin America and East Asia and less of sort of the Anglo-American tradition. And so we're probably going to see more people that want to pursue this type of housing. And those are also the folks that are having kids more these days. So it makes sense that they would also be more inclined to do so. So in short, I sort of expect to see the COVID spike to recede at some point. But I think sort of the long run trend towards this is going to continue.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
That was Nicholas Lovett, assistant professor at UW-Whitewater in the Department of Economics. He joined us to talk about an increase in multi-generational households over the last few months. Grandparents moving in with their kids and grandchildren, adult children staying home or moving back home, and more. There's still time for you to share your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Major League Baseball has had some struggles playing amid the coronavirus pandemic. The Milwaukee Brewers are already scheduled to make up three games postponed by the virus. But down the road in Kenosha, the Northwoods League has found a way to make baseball season work so far. Megan Hart has more on a new rivalry taking root there this summer.
On a recent Sunday afternoon, the Kenosha Kingfish took on the K-Town Bobbers. It was a game that months ago looked like it might not happen. When college baseball was canceled this spring, Drew Dyer didn't really know what was in store.
We had signed our contract early, so we were planning on coming out here, and we were as hopeful as we could be. But it was kind of just a day-to-day, week-to-week thing.
Now the Kenosha Kingfish catcher and Carthage College student says he's just happy to be playing baseball.
Considering this year and everything that's gone on, it's amazing that we're playing ball, we're putting on a jersey every day. It's not what it could have been with the traveling and more games, but you got to be grateful for something.
Players say it's not quite a normal summer. They don't have clubhouse access and they get temperature checks. And as Dyer alluded, there's not much travel, especially for the Kingfish. They're playing a 26-game season this summer, all against a team called the K-Town Bobbers. The K-Town Bobbers are made up of players and coaches from other Northwoods League teams that decided to sit the season out due to local coronavirus restrictions. They were created to give the Kingfish a worthy opponent this summer. Justice Bigby won league MVP last season with the Madison Mallards.
Now batting to the Bobbers, designated hitter from Western Carolina, 23, Justice Bigby.
Now he's a bobber.
I know a fan came up with the name, but I mean, kind of a bobber is like Fish's worst nightmare.
Dyer says seeing one team so many times poses some unique challenges.
So we get reports on all of them, what they throw, what their tendencies are. We got charts on them, what they did towards us. The hardest part is they kind of do the same thing against us. So they know how to pitch to us. They know how to hit our hitter or our pitchers. So it kind of goes back and forth.
Despite the unusual season, some things haven't changed. Larry and Terry Losh from Pleasant Prairie brought their 8-year-old grandson Justin to the ballpark. They ran through the highlights after the game.
Well, it was the home run.
Home run?
Yeah. My grandson getting a ball and getting it autographed, winning a T-shirt and getting that autographed. It's a good family experience here. It really is.
Both the Kingfish and the Bobbers host home games at Simmons Field, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. It's been almost 70 years since the Kenosha Comets of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League called the stadium home. The league was founded during another trying time in history. Baseball executives created it to keep the sport thriving during World War II. Karen Peterson lives just over the Illinois border. Her parents' first date was to see the Comets.
My mom always told me she didn't know anything about baseball, and she said, but she had to learn really, really quick. And now to have baseball back after this long hiatus, I said, it's wonderful. It's great. It's perfect.
It was the first game of the season for Peterson, who was there to throw out the first pitch.
Are you excited to see the Bombers?
Yeah, no. No, I'm a Kingfish fan.
Just as the Comets made baseball history, Justice Bigby thinks this season will stand out.
Me and the teammates have been talking about, we're like, yeah, this is going to be something that's going to be talked about 20 years down the road, and it's pretty cool to be a part of.
Even though they were created under these unusual circumstances, a manager at the team store said they're selling plenty of Bobbers gear, but the crowd showed a clear preference for the Kingfish.
All right. Way to go, Kingfish!
The Kingfish beat the Bobbers 2-1, taking a 9-8 lead in the series. The Kenosha season wraps up August 22nd. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, does every emergency call need a police response? We'll find out how some communities around the country are changing their emergency response systems and bringing more mental health care into the mix. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wauwatosa police officer who shot and killed 3 people over the course of 5 years remains suspended after a fire and police commission meeting last night. We'll get the latest on Joseph Mensah and the citizen complaints filed against him. First, the U.S. Conference of Mayors recently came out with recommendations on how police departments and their communities can build trust and improve public safety. The guidance includes a section on assessing the calls of service to the police. Research shows that no more than 10% of the calls police respond to involve violent crime. That's causing many local leaders to reconsider whether police officers are the best resource in some emergency situations. Some local governments are changing their emergency response programs with the goal of providing better outcomes for everyone involved. Carl Smith is a senior staff writer for Governing, where he recently wrote about this issue. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. This is an interesting topic to talk about.
Definitely. Now, before we get into particular cities' responses here around the country, can you talk about the types of calls that police are responding to as told by some of the latest research?
The calls that don't involve violence? L.A. Times recently did a survey looking through 18 million calls over 10 years, and only about 8% were violent crimes. So it's very often things that don't really require a police presence, particularly when you have your dispatchers trained to recognize situations that might go that way.
So what other kind of things, what are all these 90+% of calls that police are responding to?
Well, it can be something as simple as public intoxication. It could be a welfare check, a neighbor wanting to be sure that someone in their area is doing okay. It could be people in crisis, in some sort of mental distress. Could be domestic abuse. Could be those sorts of things.
And in your piece, you focused in on how particular cities are maybe changing the way they approach some of those situations. And interestingly, it struck me in a couple of the cases, the lead is being taken by police chiefs. They would like to see their officers, it seems like, responding to fewer of those, maybe those mental health emergencies, things like that. Can you talk about that, that from, I think, police chiefs in Denver and other big cities?
Right. It's very much true. To a large extent, what they find is because social safety nets have got holes in them, they end up being the only resource available for a situation that doesn't really constitute a law enforcement matter. And in general, police would like to be solving crime, pursuing, you know, the perpetrators of situations that are actual threats to public safety. And as much as they might personally feel some empathy for someone who got drunk and fell down and cut their knee, they don't necessarily consider that to be their job.
Talking to Carl Smith from Governing Magazine, looking at new approaches from cities around the country in their emergency response and looking for ways to have people other than police respond to some of the calls they get. Now, let's dig into some of the examples you give, starting with Eugene, Oregon, one of the longer running ones that now some other cities are looking to. What has happened there?
Right. That's really the best established program. It's been there for 38 years, and the clinic which it sprung from has actually been in the town for over 50 years. And it arose out of the community, and I think that's an important part of this. You know, we look to police when there's trouble, but the reason CAHOOTS works so well to a large extent is that it grew up out of the community itself, expressing a desire to try to provide, you know, sort of more humane and caring response in situations where it wasn't really a law enforcement situation. So the CAHOOTS teams are comprised of a medic and then a crisis worker, and they have a van, and it's organized in such a way that it's actually administered through the police department. They go out on calls when they are dispatched by the folks in the 911 system. So a 911 call comes in. If the dispatcher determines it's something CAHOOTS can respond to, they'll send the CAHOOTS folks out. The program is very much a partner with the police. And even though it's come up in the context of alternatives to police, they don't really see themselves as being in opposition to the police. They just see that there are ways that on behalf of the community, they can support the police efforts to provide a safe community and to provide appropriate assistance to folks who are in trouble.
So it sounds like part of the story here, though, is if I'm a dispatcher with this kind of system, I'm going to need some extra training, I guess, to triage. Am I dispatching this to the police themselves or to this CAHOOTS, this alternative program?
That's right. And that's very well grooved in. They responded in 2019, the last year, complete year, they responded to 24,000 calls, and they only needed backup 150 times. So that's more than 99% of the time they were absolutely able to provide what was needed. And another important part of it is that the people in the CAHOOTS teams are thoroughly aware of and have working relationships with all the various sorts of support programs in the community. So if the person that they're asked to assist is homeless and came to the attention of 911 because maybe they were out on the street, maybe they were boisterous, maybe they were drunk, whatever it might be, the CAHOOTS folks have direct relationships with the right service to send that person to. So having the van, they're able to provide transport and give them what they call a warm handoff. So they have a more deep understanding of what's available to someone in some of these situations and can get them to the right person so that you don't start out with someone in distress or someone observing someone in distress, have a call to 911, have someone go out to try to help, and then send the person to the wrong place. And I think another important thing about it in the context of looking at investments in public safety is they saved the city about $8 million a year on police calls and about $14 million on ambulance and emergency room treatment, because in the case of the medical things, if it's a cut or a scratch or someone has a cold or whatever it might be, they can give them the assistance they need. If they do need to go to an emergency room or something, they can transport them, but they may not need that. So the investment that the city and the county, they have some county funding, makes in what Cahoots is doing is returned conservatively 7 times over. So it makes sense in pretty much any way you could think of.
Now, that's Eugene, Oregon. It has a reputation, I think, of being a city that does things differently. But as you write, you've got a big city like Denver, Colorado now, looking to the Eugene example. Where is Denver in considering something like this?
Well, the police chief there, Paul Pazin, heard about the program years ago. He went out and visited. He thought it was pretty interesting. He decided to do something. There was a bond initiative, and the citizens decided they would fund a pilot program. Then Denver sent dispatchers out. You pointed that out earlier. You would need some training. They sent dispatchers out, and they got trained to know what would be an appropriate time to send one of these teams. They're calling their program Support Team Assisted Response, or STAR, and it's been going for, I guess, maybe a month and a half, 2 months now. And what the chief said is it's in certain districts only, sort of the core downtown area. And he's having officers say, hey, when can we have this in our area? We want more. We want more of these teams. And interestingly, it's perhaps in response to the Denver implementation and other events, Senator Wyden from Washington is actually going to be introducing a bill that would provide a federal program based on Cahoots using Medicaid funds and give cities up to a 95% match on any investment that they made in developing a program of their own. So that could expand this quite a lot. And actually, I was talking to the Cahoots folks earlier today, and since the death of George Floyd, they've had over 300 calls for consultation regarding putting a program such as theirs in place. The normal for an entire year, and that was the end of May when that event occurred, the normal for 1 year for them would be more like 8. So interest is exploding in this type of program. And I think it's because it makes sense, really. Yeah, it's hardly controversial.
And are you expecting, as we wrap up, Carl, other communities, other cities to start putting in maybe pilot programs like Denver started with in the next year or two?
Well, absolutely. And I know Oregon has got some other cities going, San Francisco. They already are working with others. And absolutely, because it very directly and very simply and very deeply responds to this notion that maybe that sometimes what people need is help. And here's a way to provide it humanely in coordination with police in a manner that actually saves government money. So it's a well-established 30 years of implementation approach that could give communities and some of the activists who are calling for different ways of doing things an approach that would probably make them happy.
Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Carl Smith is a senior staff writer for Governing. We talked with him about the nonviolent types of calls police officers often respond to and how some cities and community groups are rethinking their approach to policing, looking to, as we heard, different kinds of emergency response teams to be part of the picture. Coming up, we'll get you up to speed on the fate of a Wisconsin police officer who shot and killed 3 people over the past 5 years and protests in the city of Wauwatosa. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at how the overlapping crises of hurricanes, wildfires, and a pandemic may become more common as the world's climate changes. Now, a Wauwatosa police officer who shot and killed 3 people over the past 5 years remains suspended after the city's Fire and Police Commission met last night. The panel got together to discuss complaints brought by the families of the people Joseph Mensa killed while on duty. The families want Mensa fired for violating police policies. Yesterday, the commission closed two of the complaints, but opted not to act on the most recent one because it's still under investigation by the Milwaukee County District Attorney. Evan Casey is a reporter for the Now News Group with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers Wauwatosa, Brookfield, and Elm Grove. Evan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us, first of all, Evan, about the incidents in which Officer Mensa had shot and killed someone while he was in the line of duty?
Sure. So the most recent one was about 6 months ago in February. Alvin Cole was a 17-year-old teenager who was at the mall with some friends. Security was called and so was police after an incident occurred inside of the mall. After Alvin and some of his friends were outside of the mall by the Cheesecake Factory, police told him to drop a gun that he had had, that somebody reported that Alvin had a gun. About 10 seconds after that, 15 seconds after that, a police officer fired his weapon and shot and killed Alvin Cole on the scene. That officer is Joseph Mensa. His attorney said in early June, the attorney for the Cole family said that Joseph Mensa was a shooter in this incident. He also had two other shootings. One of them was in 2015 and the other one was in 2016. In 2015, Mensa shot, his name was Antonio Gonzalez, who was 25 years old at that time. He was wielding a sword at the time, and police officers say that he came at him with the sword. Mensa and another officer was involved in that shooting. The other officer, shot his gun around one time, and Mensa shot it around nine times during that incident. And then in 2016, Jay Anderson Jr., who was 25 as well, was shot and killed by Mensa. Anderson Jr. was sleeping in his car outside of a park around 3 a.m. when Mensa approached, and basically Mensa said that he saw a gun in the car and he perceived Anderson to be reaching for it during the interaction. But his family said that that wasn't true, and they're kind of mad about how the investigation was handled as well.
Those the most recent shooting is still under investigation. The previous two, as I understand it, Evan, have been investigated, and investigators ruled in both of the first two cases that he had acted appropriately. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And for the Anderson Jr. shooting in 2016 as well, the Milwaukee Police Department, the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and also the Wauwatosa Police Department themselves investigated that incident, and all of them found that there was no wrongdoing during that incident.
And what is the status of the most recent shooting? Who is investigating that, and where is that right now?
Sure. Yeah, so it's been a long few months here. The Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office is still investigating any criminal wrongdoing into Mensa for that shooting. But currently, the Wauwatosa Police and Fire Commission, they are basically the commission who has a say in regarding firing any officers or the police chief. They suspended Officer Mensa in July 15th, and basically he's still suspended while an independent third-party investigator investigates, once again, the Anderson Jr. shooting. So until that time, we don't really know what the future holds for Mensa, if he's going to be fired or not. It's likely that that investigation by the third-party investigator will be complete, I would say, late October, I think the commission said last night. And so then any ruling possibly from the commission would likely come, honestly, in November, December. So it's still a few months out yet.
I want to give a listen to Officer Mensa defending himself during an interview he did with WISN Radio in Milwaukee. This is from last month.
Not one person has been able to come to me or give me any explanation for why I'm suspended other than, oh, you shot somebody. Even though it's justified, proven justified. Violated no policies, no procedures, the Milwaukee Police Department, the District Attorney's Office, and the U.S. Attorney's Office to investigate civil rights violations determined I did absolutely nothing wrong, yet I'm still suspended. For what?
Is there an official reason from the Fire and Police Commission as to why he's suspended in the course of this investigation of the most recent shooting?
Sure. Yeah, so they're saying that it's due to the complaints filed by the attorney for the Anderson Jr. family. And by the way, the attorney for the Cole family, the Anderson Jr. family, and the Gonzalez family is the same lady. Her name is Kimberly Motley. She basically, in the middle of June, she made a complaint with the Wauwatosa Police Department and the commission regarding Officer Mensa. And so right now they're saying that he's suspended due to the ongoing investigation into that matter.
We're talking to Evan Casey, reporter for Now News Group with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers Wauwatosa, Brookfield, and Elm Grove. We're talking about an ongoing story involving a Wauwatosa police officer who's shot and killed three people, been investigated for two of them, the third one going on, ruled that he had not violated police procedure in the previous two. I want to get to another part of this story, Evan, ongoing protests in Wauwatosa. Can you share some of the history of what's been going on with very prominent protests in the area?
Yeah, so in early June, right around the time that protests were occurring across the nation, the attorney, Kimberly Motley, basically went public with the information that her that she had found out that Mensa was a shooter of Alvin Cole. And so right around that time, I want to say that was June 6th that she made that we published that story. We were the first to publish that story. And since that time, there's literally been protests in and around Wauwatosa every day. A lot of them have been focused in on the Wauwatosa Police Department. They'll march there. They marched to the Mayfair Mall, which is where Alvin Cole was shot and killed. They've also been marching recently to the mayor's house as well. And then also on August 8th, that's about 12 days ago, they also marched to Officer Mensa's girlfriend's house as well when he was home during that time. And that's that incident, which involves a shotgun and a lot of toilet paper, has really caught national attention. The Washington Post reported on it. And so it's been kind of a national story since that time. And so protesters have continued to be at the mayor's house basically every night since that time. Two of them were arrested last week, Friday, by Wauwatosa police after the city basically said that they wouldn't allow any protests to occur there after 8 p.m. That occurred just for one day. The city lifted that on Friday of last week, but that's still the day that protesters were arrested by the police department. So, yeah, it's been a very heated few weeks here in Wauwatosa. A lot of people are still angry that Officer Mensa is only suspended and not fired yet. And so the goal of the protest is really to get him fired and removed from the police department.
Can you take just our last couple of minutes, Evan, to talk about that incident? This is probably what most people might have seen in the headlines, this very heated confrontation with different stories from the police department and protesters. Can you sum up what we do and don't know about that?
Yeah. So what we do know is that the protesters left Mayfair Mall on Saturday, August 8th, and they walked to Target to get some toilet paper. Then they walked from Target to the Officer Mensa's girlfriend's home. And at the time, Officer Mensa said that also his girlfriend's children were home as well, as well as his girlfriend's. So they marched to his home. They marched with cars in the front, protesters in the middle, then cars in the back as well to kind of protect them. Then when protesters got to the house, they say that Officer Mensa was on his front lawn and he was yelling at protesters and kind of wanted to start, I guess, an incident during that time. He said that's not true. He said that he was there to protect his property and his home during that time. But what we do know, and we have video of this, that protesters were throwing toilet paper on the house. Some of it hit his window. And then also kind of the big incident that occurred was a gunshot was fired. Now, Representative David Bowen, who was there at that time, said that he believes that Mensa fired that gun himself. But Mensa himself, in a Facebook post, and just, as he said in interviews, has said that that shotgun round was fired into his back door. And the police department has also been saying that as well. So we won't really know what is, I guess, happened exactly until the investigation is complete. The Wauwatosa Police Department is handling that currently. The police chief for Wauwatosa said that they know who they believe shot the gun, but we really have no extra information about that at this time.
In just our last 30 seconds or so, Evan, what are you watching for next with a lot going on here?
Yeah, so I'll be looking for the ruling from the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office to see if there was any criminal wrongdoing into the Cole shooting. And then also, like I said, in late October is when the investigation into the complaints from the Anderson Jr. family will be complete. So I'll be watching for that as well.
Evan, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Evan Casey is a reporter for Now News Group with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers Wauwatosa, Brookfield, and Elm Grove. We talked to him today about Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Mensa, the three people he had shot and killed while on duty over the last 5 years, citizen complaints against him, his uncertain future with the department, and ongoing protests in Wauwatosa. You can keep watching for his coverage over at the Journal Sentinel website, JS Online. And you can also follow coverage from WPR over at WPR.org/news. And you can watch for ongoing coverage of police related issues at WPR.org/news and WisContext.org. If you are of a certain age and want to travel back into a nostalgic past, here's an opportunity for you. A sleepover in the world's last remaining Blockbuster video store. Video rental stores rose and fell in my lifetime, lots of independent local ones, and the big chain, Blockbuster, swept across the country. But the rise of streaming video has led to the downfall of most, but not all, video stores, big and small. There is one Blockbuster video store still standing, somehow, in Bend, Oregon. And they have a special offer on Airbnb. They'll remake their store for a few nights of slumber parties, specifically a 90s-themed sleepover. They're renting out the location for three nights in mid-September for just $4 a night, apparently. I'm not clear on whether that's first come, first served, if it's per person, if you're just doing it with strangers. I'm not sure about that. You'll be able to hang out in a beanbag chair with some popcorn and watch 90s movies. And in maybe related news, the Blockbuster Video Twitter feed tweeted last week for the first time in about 6.5 years. First tweet, just checking in. Second tweet, okay, we've seen enough. Checking out. Be kind, rewind. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.